Gad Ransom, presented at Concordia Seminary on the 24th of January, 1967.
Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you in the name of the president of the seminary, Dr. Gerbringer, who we know this of a series of forums that we've been holding this year, part of our lecture series. Tonight's forum is under the general direction of Professor Walter Wagner of our Department of Exegetical Theology of the Old Testament. Mr. Wagner.
Thank you, Dean Rep. I arrived home for the evening meal. Noticed that this week's issue of Time Magazine had arrived, and probably some of you have seen the article based on the current events in Israel, beginning with a statement to the effect that in the region of Galilee, area where Jesus preached the gospel of redemption, Arabs and Israeli soldiers were facing one another's cannon. I think that lead sentence in that article in today's issue of Time highlights the Arab-Israeli crisis, which is the topic of our consideration this evening. We are privileged to have with us Mr. Gad Ramon, Council of Israel, who is the Council for Press and Information of the Consulate General of Israel, the Chicago office, with a special responsibility for press and information on behalf of Israel in the entire Midwest. Mr. Ramon is a native of Israel. He finished his primary and high school years there. He was a member of a kibbutz, formerly the Kibbutz Gilboa, now known as Kibbutz Yisrael. In 1950, 51, and 52, he served in the Israeli Defense Forces. From 1953 to 1958, he studied economics, specializing in international relations and Oriental studies at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Already prior to completing his studies at the university in 1957, he joined government service in Israel, serving as the main assistant to the director of the Department of Development of the Negev, and from 1960 to 62 was main assistant to the director Department for International Cooperation of the Israeli Ministry for Foreign Affairs. So, during those years, he has not only lived in Israel, but knows the affairs of the country, both as a citizen, a soldier, and as an officer in the government. In 1962, he was assigned to Manila, where he served as Second Secretary to the Embassy of Israel, and in 1965 was promoted to first secretaryship in that same office, and serves now here in this country, in Chicago, in the office already mentioned. I can give you this background to let you see that we have a gentleman who should be able to speak with us authoritatively in presenting the Israeli point of view on the present Arab-Israeli conflict in the Middle East. After Mr. Ramon has completed his presentation, we will call upon members of our panel, consisting of Professor Carl Gresser and Professor Alfred von Morris Sauer, both of Concordia Seminary, and Professor Lionel Quiston, Jr., of the faculty of Eden Seminary. We will ask each of these men to make a brief response to the presentation of Mr. Ramon. The response may very well include questions which they wish to address to him, and we will then give Mr. Ramon an opportunity to respond to their questions. And we hope also to have time left to involve the entire group in discussion, so you may wish to prepare your own questions or comments to what you address to what you hear now. Without further ado, then, I turn the microphone over to our speaker, Mr. God Ranone.
Such a high panel of high experts and of such a distinguished audience, which reminds me of the story about three boys, an American boy, a French boy, and an Israeli boy. And you know how boys behave. They want to compete and show how important they are. So the American boy said, "Boys, have you heard about the Empire State Building?" "Yes, of course, the tallest building in the world." "My father built it, so they're beautiful." And the French boy asked, "Have you heard about the Eiffel Tower?" And they said, "Of course, the famous Eiffel Tower. Very nice. My father built it. Very happy and promising." The police very well didn't know what to say. He scratched his head and said, "Boys, have you heard about the Dead Sea?" They said, "Yes, my father killed it." So, I won't speak about the Dead Sea, but some problems around this area. And with your kind permission, I will make a brief historical remarks, although I'm sure, I hope you won't see it as an offense, just for the sake of building up my lecture. As you know, the bond of the Jewish people with the land of Israel is 4,000 years old. During half of this period, the land of Israel was wholly Jewish in sovereignty. After a period of tribal organization and government by judges, a monarchy emerged under King Saul. His successor David consolidated the kingdom and made Jerusalem its capital. About 930 BC, on the death of King Solomon, who built the temple, the kingdom was split into two realms, Judea and Israel. The expansion of the Assyrian and Babylonian empires dominated first Israel and the later Judea, and many Jews were exiled to Babylon in 586 BC. The return of Jews in the days of Emperor Cyrus of Persia, 70 years later, and the building of the Second Temple began a period of revival and the creation of what historians call the Second Commonwealth. For four centuries, the land of Israel enjoyed a large measure of self-rule under Persian and Hellenistic tutelage. When in 168 BC, Seleucid Syria interfered with that autonomy, the Jewish people revolted and regained full independence, which lasted over two centuries in the kingdom of the Hasmoneans and their successors. Toward the close of this period, the Jewish people, in a series of uprisings and wars, resisted the Roman Empire, it's about 63 BC, which had conquered the whole Near East. Ultimately, in 70 AD, Roman power subdued the Judea, destroyed the Second Temple, and a part of the nation was exiled to various countries of the Roman Empire. After two generations, the Jews Jewish people revolted again against the Romans, and independence was briefly restored in 132-135 AD under Shimon Bar Kokhba. The land of Israel was thereafter occupied by successive invaders and conquerors, Arabs 637-1072, Seljuks 1072-1099, Crusaders 1099-1291, Mamluks 1291-1517, Ottoman Turks 1517-1917, and finally under the British Mandate, which as we know was granted to Britain by the League of Nations, and this and their rule lasted from 1917 to 1948. Many other peoples have lost their independence under the heels of invading empires. But no people, other than the Jewish people, having been so engulfed, has shown such capacity for recuperation as to preserve amidst martyrdom and dispersion all the elements of its union and identity, its language and tradition, its consciousness of attachment to the land of its origin, and the undying hope of eventual national redemption. For long centuries, this people, wherever it wandered, continued to regard its inner life as rooted in a distant land which few could even hope to see with their own eyes. This connection, which for many generations was an act of mystic faith, became transformed against all material calculations into one of the political realities of this century. My dear friends, I would prefer to tell you about the pioneer of the 19th century Jewish National Renaissance Movement, the founders of the Third Commonwealth, who were urged by an utopian dream, a vision of Jewish redemption, and of an ideal society where competition would be replaced by cooperation. I would prefer to tell you the saga of sacrifices which have transformed the wilderness to a semblance of its ancient fertility. I would prefer to describe you the epic of mass immigration, which brought hundreds of thousands of returning exiles. I would like to tell you about the revival of Hebrew, of the great efforts and at times impressive achievements, and the increase of industrial and agricultural resources. I would like to tell you about the formation of a new culture, welding many varied immigrant traditions and experiences into the unified tapestry of a distinctive civilization in the image of the ancient Hebrew past. There is in Israel the adventure of establishing within a region dominated by despotism, autocracy, and dictatorship, a sanctuary for the democratic way of life and the principles of free government. I would prefer to tell you about the achievements in literature, the sciences, and art, which without yet reaching the peaks of the ancient revelations, are yet significant and promising in relation to the circumstances and time and other objective condition factors in which they have been accomplished. And last, but not least, the achievements of a large international recognition within so so brief a time, and against such heavy challenges, which I will try to emphasize later, is also, as I mentioned, among the notable accomplishments of my country. Since the topic, as the distinguished chairman mentioned, assigned to me is the Middle East crisis, I will overlook my personal preferences and concentrate on the assigned subject exclusively. And I do hope that in a humble way, I will justify your expectations. The United Nations decided on November 29, 1947, to divide Palestine into two countries, a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Arab countries, who were then members of the United Nations organization, extremely opposed the UN decision. On May 14, 1948, the day Israel declared its independence, four Arab states, which have common border with us and Iraq, declared war against us in order to crush the newly established state. That war ended with the General Armistice Agreements of 1949, which put a permanent end to hostilities, banned all violence or threats of violence between the countries concerned, and was supposed to serve a short transition stage to a final peace. That transition stage has now lasted 17 years, and peace is not, unfortunately, in sight. Contrary to the United Nations Charter and contrary to the General Armistice Agreements, Arab governments proclaim that they do not accept the political independence and the territorial integrity of Israel. The Arab government's refusal to recognize Israel gives them no right and releases them from no obligations. It merely proves their lack of realism and of international responsibility. Israel's sovereignty is not subject to Arab consent, as the sovereignty of the United States is not subject to the consent of her political adversaries. The standing practice and the interdependence of the contemporary world created a system of international rights and duties which not even our self-declared enemies are free to ignore and abuse. Whether they like it or not, irrespective of all their views and emotions, the governments of our neighboring countries have obligations toward Israel, which they are bound to respect and which Israel is entitled to invoke. I'm sure that you are familiar with the details of the organized terrorism and sabotage across our borders, which in the last 2 years have increased to an average of 2 a week, and in the last few weeks, even more than that. For many months, the government of Israel has acted with great self-restraint as outrage after outrage took place from across the borders. We brought the whole problem of these border raids and their political background before the United Nations Security Council. This was October 12, 1966. There is no doubt that the regrettable inability of the Security Council to deal with the fundamentals of the problem and to adopt a firm decision. decision has encouraged an Arab aggression. Our government has stated many times that we are not in the habit of interfering in the internal affairs of our neighboring countries. We have no interest in the nature of their regimes, although we would like to see presidents of our neighboring countries not being elected by a majority of 94.8%. We are not interested in their social outlook or the orientation of their foreign policy. We are interested in one point alone, namely, are the governments of our neighboring countries prepared to honor their obligations toward Israel as defined in the United Nations Charter and in the 1949 General Armistice Agreements? The urgent issue in the short run is the continuation of Arab aggression with all its grave consequences, or the immediate restoration of stability. Prime Minister Eshkol stated clearly in the parliament, in the Knesset, on January 17th, and I quote, "If we refrain from reacting immediately to the Syrian aggression, it is only because, in accordance with our basic policy to exhaust all political and diplomatic possibilities of restraining aggression in any shape or form." The tragedy of the Arab-Israeli conflict is in the fact that it is an asymmetrical conflict. And what I mean by an asymmetrical conflict is, let's take, for instance, the Indian-Pakistani conflict, wherein one side says A, but the other side says B, then maybe the solution, as usually, would be C. This, unfortunately, is not the case in the Arab-Israeli conflict. But even the pessimistic observer cannot ignore the beginning of a process, though modest in its indications, which eventually will lead to a change in the situation as known to us in the last 18 years. Observers mention that a turning point in the traditional Arab attitude toward the Arab-Israeli conflict was initiated by President Habib Bourguiba of Tunisia, who challenged the official Arab dogma about Israel's place in the Middle East. President Bourguiba of Tunisia indicated that Israel is a deep-rooted reality in the Middle East, as well as in the world community, with which the Arab governments will have to come to terms. The Arab refusal to acknowledge Israel's existence is fed by the vast disparity between the power relationship of the two parties in the conflict. What is mistakenly called the Arab world consists of 13 sovereign states with 4.2 million square miles and a population of almost 100 million. My country, as you know, is as small as Massachusetts. Its area is exactly 8,453 square miles, and its population less than 3 million. The Arab thesis of the disparity between the parties is therefore reflected in such advantages as area, population, mineral wealth, and in particular oil, strategic importance, and an impressive capacity for diplomatic manipulation, especially in international organizations where numbers count. from this multiple advantage, many Arab leaders draw the simple conclusion that Israel's survival depends on Arab consent, while they stand in no corresponding need of peace with Israel. My dear friends, to those who see the components of nationhood, statesmanship, and history in these terms, the lesson of the years since Israel gained its statehood can harvest nothing but astonishment and frustration. The Arab strategy, inspired mainly and directed from Egypt, has planned in the past 15 years a number of clearly defined objectives, namely to destroy Israel's independence, to reduce her territory, to uproot Jerusalem, to sabotage her diplomatic relations, to prevent her participation in international and regional organizations, to boycott her growth as a trading unit with access to the world markets, to place obstacles in the way of the development of the country and in particular in its water resources, to discredit her in world opinion, and above all, to banish her from affirmative relations with the newly independent nations of Asia and Africa. Ladies and gentlemen, none of these aims has been achieved. Israel exists in growing strength and numbers, and our territory as defined in the 1949 the General Armistice Agreement is intact. Jerusalem is an integral part of the national structure, and the fact that it being our old new capital is an unquestionable fact. We have a network of diplomatic relations with 96 countries, broader than is usual for so small a state. We participate actively in all international institutions which express the growth of the world community. The Arab boycott has had some tactical successes, but has not prevented Israel from creating commercial relations with other 100 states, or from expanding her exports by more than 1,000% in 18 years of independence. The national water carrier operates since May 1964, in spite of the Arab leaders' summits and the noise which they made in a series of summit meetings in Cairo, Casablanca, and Damascus. World opinion overwhelmingly supports Israel, and the majority of the emerging states maintain strong and intimate ties with us. These relations with the developing countries go beyond the diplomatic purposes. They touch the central interest of the awakening nations in their search for an accelerated social and economic development. If the factors which have determined Israel's consolidation for the past 19 years can be presumed to last for the next 90 years and beyond, then the leaders of our neighboring countries can hardly evade the sort of intellectual adjustment which one of them, at least, namely President Habib, communications. We could imagine communications running from Haifa to Beirut, Damascus, and Istanbul in the north, to Amman and beyond to the east, and to Cairo in the south, across the southern Negev, between the Nile Valley and the Fertile Crescent. The new contacts could be assumed without any political change. What is now often described as a wedge between the Arab countries would become a bridge. The Kingdom of Jordan, or the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, now cut off from its access to the Mediterranean, could freely import and export its goods on the Israeli coast. Economic cooperation, agricultural and industrial development could lead to supranational arrangements like those which mark the EEC. The United Nations could establish an economic commission for the Middle East, similar to the commissions now at work in Europe, Latin America, Africa, and the Far East. The development of arid zones and desalination of seawater and the conquest of tropical diseases are of common interest of the entire region, and we believe that we could make a substantial contribution to the solution of those problems. Regional water development would become a focus of cooperation instead of a source of conflict. The old prejudices could be replaced by a new, healthy, and normal approach of respect, born as a result of a reciprocal dialogue in the various spheres of life. In such a Middle East, military budgets would spontaneously find a less exacting point of equilibrium. Enormous sums of money devoted now to the national security of the countries of the region could be partly at least diverted to development projects. For the first time in history, no East Mediterranean nation is subject to foreign rule. All enjoy sovereign freedom. The challenge is to translate freedom into a creative relationship. It may seem utopian to project such a vision of the Middle East in the first month of 1967, when the urgent concern is to reinforce the factors of stability against armed conflict. But we do believe that there is no other alternative except to come to terms of understanding. We, the Jewish people, always keep before our eyes the historic magnitude and meaning of all that we have gone through. 2,000 years of freedom and 2,000 years of hope. And we surely hope that the day of peace, which God knows that our neighbors need and we deserve, is not as far as it seems.
Thank you, Mr. Anon. I'd like to explain that when